Falcons outstanding. A lot of great reviews from his breakdown last week, and he joins us usually on Thursdays. It's a day early today. We got White Sox baseball tomorrow afternoon, so we're going to have a short show, Waddle and me. So we decided to put Dan on today, and then we'll check in with Jesse Rogers coming up later in the 4 o'clock hour with the Tony La Russa news that Tony is out indefinitely, and we'll get more medical testing with his regular doctors in Arizona. So Jesse from Guaranteed Rate Field coming up here shortly. A lot of reaction to my list, but let's talk Bears as they picked up six today. And also Tajae Sharpe will be out for the year. That was something that
a surprise.
Yes, on the injured reserve. That is not a four-week thing. That is a year. He is out officially for the year. Dan Durkin joins us right now. Hi, Dan. How you feeling?
Doesn't sound like Dan is with us right now.
No, I'm with you guys. I'm muting myself. Yep. I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Mute yourself. Don't do that.
It defeats the purpose of talking to people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So let's get your takeaway from Leatherwood, the pickup of Leatherwood, and what they've done with the roster.
Yeah, so, you know, Leatherwood is a guy that, you know, I think when I think about the pickups here, we talked a little bit about this last week in terms of this is pure eval year for the Bears, and they need to take as many spins at the wheel to find the right combination of offensive linemen, ideally younger ones that they can build around. So when you think about Leatherwood and who he was in college and who he's, you know, shown so far in the NFL, I think he's a potentially workable guard. My biggest concerns about him last year, footwork problems, you know, definite footwork problems, particularly in pass pro. Just a lot of penalties, gave up a lot of sacks just because I don't think his feet were right and things a little bit slower. You know, something needs to speed up there, whether he's thinking too much or whether it's just general footwork and technique. Something didn't seem right there. But in the run game, I think that he's definitely plus. And so, like, that's what you look for is who can function with mobility and strength in this zone run game and hold up at the point of attack when you have somebody on your face or climb up to the second level. So when you look at where this team was and you think about what the combination could be, I think they could run through three or four or five different starting line combinations this year just to try and find what's the best group up front. You know, is Lucas Patrick best as guard? Is he best at center? Is Tevin best at right guard? Is he best at tackle? Is Larry Borum somebody they might want to look at guard as well? I think that they're going to need to get as much eval as possible with these different potential pieces and see which ones stick. And so the Leatherwood, again, betting on somebody that has some upside. You know, you think about 50% of his contract has already been paid for, and if he does work out, you have that fifth-year option. So I think a relatively low risk when you do the risk-reward calculus here for the Bears to take. And then the guy I really like is Watts from the Vikings.
Five sacks last year.
Yeah, we talked last week about, you know, what were the positions that I was going to be focused on, you know, going into that game. And I talked to you guys, like, guys, I'm still kind of concerned about the depth of the interior defensive line. And so now you get a guy who was a starter with the Minnesota Vikings. Not only was he a starter, he was a contributor. I think he had five sacks, two forced fumbles last year, and is a guy that primarily played the one technique, so over the nose. But now that they're shifting to this 3-4 scheme, he's kind of odd man out. But now I think he'll fit perfectly in a 4-3 and be able to play a 3 technique. And then maybe when they do slide to and under, he can play over the nose as well. So I like that pickup in terms of everybody that they made today to be the biggest contributor early for that team.
Dan, what do you make of their decision not to claim any wide receivers? And what does that say about maybe a couple of the kids that are on the practice squad will be elevated for a while?
Yeah, and I think that we talked a little bit about this one as well. Is wide receiver is a pretty technical position, Tom. You know that quite well. So when you think about somebody that you need to bring into your building now and in 10 to 11 days, can you get this person familiar with our terminology, his assignments, his responsibilities, scramble rules, blocking, all of those types of things? And so that's a tall ask. I think that focusing more on offensive and defensive linemen, where their responsibilities and their keys are a little bit more simplified, makes more sense to me. by no means do the Bears have what I would consider to be a wide receiver group that would prevent them or should prevent them from looking to pick up somebody else. But guys, I really think people should start training their eyes more towards the collegiate level. Watch an Ohio State game, you know, this fall. Watch an LSU game this fall, because I think you're probably going to find the next Bears number one wide receiver on those games and not on Sundays. And so I think that this is just a matter of who can we get in now that can give us reps versus somebody that needs to come in and completely learn a new terminology, a new scheme, and their place in it. I think it's a tall ask for this team at this point.
Yeah, there's no doubt. This front office is playing the long game, not the short game. Let's go back to the offensive line. I have several questions attached to Tevin Jenkins. What do you make of what you've seen from him? What ultimately do you believe they will decide to do with him, and why? Triple barrel question for you.
Yeah.
Why do you believe that there is still, I feel some discontent. I feel some friction that still exists between this team and him. Answer all of that if you can.
Yeah, I do think that the relationship isn't quite as warm and fuzzy as it should be or could be at this point in time. And I'm not sure if that is just his attitude and how he comports himself, amongst his team, or more immediately amongst his peer, our offensive lineman, how coachable is he? You know, that's one thing that we just don't know, and you're not really going to get those types of answers in a scrum or in a media session, because they're going to be very guarded when it comes to, you know, what's the dirt, what's the real, what's really going on here. But in terms of how he's been playing on the field, guys, for somebody who's only in his second week as right guard, he's playing as well as anybody on that offensive line. I think that he's really taken to this role. I love what I see. I talked to you guys about this from the beginning. I love the demeanor and the nasty that he plays with. He has immediately contributed to a little bit more physicality that's been lacking since like the Kyle Long days. You need a little bit of that. You need that type of just like churn and strain on the offensive line, and a guy who plays like the echo of the whistle. He is definitely somebody that does that. So I love how he's contributed in the run game, and he's held his own in the pass game as well. You know, yeah, I've had a couple reps that I've kind of highlighted where, you know, maybe he lost his anchor a little bit quicker, but he's able to rebound. He's able to move his hips and open and mirror. So I think that's his tackle days coming back. But once he gets his hands on the guys, very strong, able to redirect and able to, you know, push somebody against their will, which is what you want to see. So I'd say at a minimum, they have a viable day one starter. And if this perceived schism that might exist between he and the coaching staff or he and his position coach, maybe that manifests over time. I think you've bought yourself an insurance policy with somebody like Alex Leatherwood.
What do you, on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you in Braxton Jones?
Okay, about a 6. You know, at this point, what I do like about him is he has great feet in his ability to, if he's been knocked off his anchor or maybe he's overset, he has the ability to slide and get back in front of his blocking assignment. Still has some strength concerns with him, and that's not, you know, uncommon for a rookie that's coming in. But when you think about fifth-round rookie who really kind of stepped into this role just a couple months ago and has owned the position and has really not necessitated a lot of help, be it from, you know, a tight end or a running back chipping to his side, I think that, you know, for a fifth round pick, this is a definite early win for the Poles regime. But my concerns about him are play strengths and, you know, how he can develop that in season. Kind of hard to do because his head is swimming with what's my responsibility right here? What happens if they show pressure? Are we on the same page? Do we know our calls? Are Cody and I on the same page? Like those types of things. But in terms of his ability to step in and play day one, I think he's going to be an adequate starter with some high potential. So I'd say, overall, fairly confident with his ability in the passing game. Would like to see him be a little bit more assertive in the run game, both with just how quickly he gets off the ball and when he actually gets to his blocking assignment. I'd like to see him finish a little bit more.
Dan Durkin joins us usually on Thursdays. He's joining us right now. You can follow him on Twitter at DJ Durkin, and also check out his YouTube page, The All 22 Review. When you watched the final game of the Bears preseason, what did the tape tell you about Justin Fields?
I mean, I liked it. It. To me, this was the first time where you saw game planning that suited him, game planning he was clearly in command of. But, you know, on top of just curating a set of plays that he's comfortable playing in, the timing was so crisp in this game. And you just haven't seen that, be it blocking breakdowns or maybe his footwork was a little bit more rushed than the receiver's route was. So he was ready to throw before the receiver was. But you saw him getting settled, being definitive with where he was going with the ball and getting rid of it on time. He had some anticipatory throws, which you like to see. So what I mean by that is at the top of his drop, before the receiver has actually made the last break in his route, the ball is out or the ball is coming out. His hands are separating. So now you know this is where I'm going with the ball. So very sure of where he was going with it. And I just liked some of the concepts that I saw from Luke Getsy. That's the thing that stood out to me. And, you know, setting Justin up for success. And I you know, that you think about the deep curl that they ran to, I believe it was Equanimeous St. Brown. Great route, but just a great design. Seven-man pass pro, seven-step drop, give him a little bit more time to get back there and set up and just rip a ball. But then even the little ones, like the touchdown to Ryan Griffin, that to me was my favorite rep. How they targeted and they gave him pre-snap indicators with formation and personnel. These are the types of situations where coaches are, quote, giving, you know, their students the answers to the test. And so what I mean by that is there are certain things you can do as an offensive coordinator to give your quarterback some pre-snap intelligence. And on that particular play, what I loved so much was 12 personnel, so two tight ends are on the field, and then you split one of those tight ends, Cole Kmet, down to basically the number one wide receiver. Now, if that was man coverage, they wouldn't have walked a cornerback out over him, but they did. And then in the slot, you had St. Brown, who had a safety over him. Clear indicator to Justin, I have zone, so now my eyes are targeting even a more narrow portion of the field. And then I just think from the way that Cole released into that route, I think it was by design. He was a little bit slower, so he kept the attention of the cornerback. Free release from Griffin. Now it's a bang-bang throw to the corner in an absolute dime. It's stuff like that that just makes me realize Luke Getsy is a very creative offensive mind. I think that his concepts are a little bit more advanced than what you've seen from Nagy over the past couple of years, and they are all intended to be something that Justin can operate from. So highly encouraged by what I saw in the last game against the Browns.
So now the hard part. Now you get to the regular season, and teams are now going to game plan for you. If you're trying to defend this Bears offense with Justin at the helm, how are you going about trying to slow him down? And then what does Luke Getsy do to counter what you're trying to do against him?
Honestly, like I would, if I were an opposing defensive coordinator, I would be mugging the A-gap, so walking linebackers up into the A-gap just about every snap, even if they're not going to come on a blitz. This is what Mike Zimmer likes to do a lot in Minnesota, or like to do a lot in Minnesota. Walk the linebackers up, because now all of a sudden the line's like, you know, I've got this guy. The back now becomes part of the protection. They're sliding one way. They're manning to the other. So all types of confusion is getting created by the offensive line, and then they're simulating pressure. So you're getting the feeling like, hey, they might be bringing seven, and we only have six. Like, okay, so now I got to motion a guy down, maybe take him out of the route, and then they may feign it and not actually run the blitz. And so if I were opposing defensive coordinator, I would do everything possible to test what I think is a still gelling and young offensive line. Simulated pressures to me would be the way to go, because I think you could really frazzle and get them to move one way and then maybe single up the guy that they were looking to get freed up. And now when you think about their opponent, that only gets even more scary when you think about Nick Bosa, Eric Armstead, Javon Kinlaw, Dee Ford, people like that. So I think you're going to see a lot of both simulated and actual pressure coming from the 49ers very early, because what they want to do more than anything is get the Bears in a predictable passing situation, because I just don't think the offensive line is going to hold up when Nick Bosa knows I don't even need to worry about the run and I can just rush the pass.
Do you think that most teams will also try to play like a shell coverage in the back half, that they'll play a lot of cover two and force the Bears to beat you with, you know, obviously you get them out of that by running the football, but by doing that, Dan, don't you A, force the young quarterback have to process, and B, it protects you from some of the boot action and stuff, because you will have somebody pretty much on each sideline?
Yeah, and you're keeping seven sets of eyes in the defensive backfield right on the quarterback. So if he does break, now you don't have to worry about, you know, when if you're playing man coverage against him, that's back, so defenders back to the quarterback. And so then they need to communicate like, hey, he's out of the pocket now. You need to turn around and make a tackle. So I do think zone would be another thing on top of it. So simulated pressure, zone shells in the back end, seven eyes in the quarterback. That way you can potentially negate some of the scrambling and like the off-schedule plays. And that to me is going to be a recipe. But, you know, it is a double-edged sword, because when you think about the Bears' ability to run the ball, I think it's pretty good. And so you need to maintain that commitment to force them to drop a safety. That's when you hit them with the play action. That's when you hit them with a bootleg. And now all of a sudden you might have somebody that's stacked on top of a safety or a cornerback deep out there. But my anticipation is teams are really going to test this offensive line early, not only because there's some talent questions. I just think there's going to be a lot of communication issues given how young this group is, and they're still trying to figure it out.
Dan Durkin joining us for a couple more minutes. Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000. Courtney Cronin, who covers the team for ESPN, tweeted some Roquan Smith quotes talking about if he's still hopeful that he's going to work out a long-term deal. He said, quote, "I'm not focused on that. If I'm being completely honest, my focus is on making this year the best year I can and then go from there. I don't want to look forward too much to the future." At the end of the season, Dan, do you believe Roquan Smith will endear himself even more to this new front office and coaching staff where they will come to some sort of an agreement?
It's a tough one because, you know, I think about all of the other needs and more pressing needs of this team. And I think about what teams have gotten by with Will linebackers in 4-3 schemes. Lance Briggs was a third round draft pick out of Arizona and is a phenomenal football player. Do you need, and eventually Lance earned that. Don't get me wrong. Roquan has earned his payday. I'm just wondering, has he earned his payday on this team? And that's the tension in my head that's not giving me like a really clear picture of what this is going to look like by the end of the season. But I mean, I trust Roquan to be, you know, productive. I think that they're going to funnel a lot of plays to him. I think he's going to make a ton of tackles. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, do you want to then have to commit that chunk of your salary cap? I'd be more inclined to go out there and buy an offensive tackle. I'd, you know, like that's just me, or a pass rusher, whatever it is that you're really looking for. So I just inherently struggle with the idea of, hey, we've just now put ourselves in a position where we're going to have over $100 million in cap space, but we're going to automatically cut a fifth of that out for a weak side linebacker. I just don't know how much of a premium position that is. I trust Roquan to be a pro. I trust Roquan to be probably amongst the, you know, 5-6 top tacklers in the league. I just really am very curious, and I guess I'm probably leaning on the side that the answer is going to be no. I just don't sense something that tells me that Ryan Poles is like, we need a Will linebacker in order to make this team incrementally better and closer to a Super Bowl. So I guess my sense is he'll have a strong season, but I have doubts about this becoming a long-term partnership.
Dan, as we creep towards them getting ready for week one, how do you feel about this team overall? I think Sylvie and I are on the same page. We like the organizational composure. We like some of the things they've done. We recognize there's a talent gap. But overall, I feel pretty optimistic about the plan that this group has put together.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that's just emphasized with, obviously, turning, what was it, 5 or 6 picks into 11 in the draft, making 6 waiver claims. It's clear to me that Ryan Poles is in search mode, just like John Schneider was when he was early on with the Seahawks. It was like tons of acquisitions, using the bottom part of the roster to always bring in guys for tryouts, and that, you know, constantly in flux at the bottom of the roster. It's all about fit, and it's all about who's going to stick with this long term. It's eyes ahead with this group, and so I am highly encouraged by what he's done to stick with a developmental approach to this. Let's not get sucked into, ooh, this guy could help us because we have an acute need here now. It's like, no, they are playing the long game, and I think that's the right way of framing it up for people, is long view perspective here. Like what I see. I like the discipline. I think that it was a very early test for him in the, you know, the staring contest that he had with Roquan, and I think that he won that one. So really eager to see who, you know, comes out. You know, we talked about this before, who are going to be the other pillar players that the Bears can count on, you know, other than Justin Fields. So a successful season to me would be measurable progress from Justin Fields, a healthy season from Justin Fields. I'd say 2 offensive linemen that you can really bank yourself around saying, these guys are cornerstones for us now. We're going to build around them. And then who else other than Darnell Mooney is going to step up and be a playmaker? I think the needs on the defense are fairly obvious to me. They're going to need to really get a 3 technique. They're going to need to get a dedicated pass rusher. That's obvious now before the season even starts. But I'm more focused on how they can make the offense incrementally better. So who's along for this ride with Justin Fields?
Yeah, on that note, real quick, I think we're on the same page with Cole Kmet, more of an inline wide tight end than a guy that you split out. A little sticky, but have you seen things in the preseason in his play and how they're using him that give you hope that he can take a significant step this year?
I have, and you know, it comes down to those, you know, like you saw the screenplay that they ran against the Seahawks, and then, you know, they ran that 3-level stretch, you know, off of play action, that boot action. So finding ways to scheme him open and then making him maybe the high and a high low where you have, him and a running back, or him and, you know, maybe Darnell Mooney on a hide route coming across that are high-lowing, like the flat defender on that side. I don't anticipate him being like the Travis Kelce running an option route, beating a, you know, your nickel corner or your strong safety that's walked up to defend him. But being able to scheme plays for him, I think that he's going to be effective there. Would like to see him continue to be a little bit more productive when it comes to yards after the catch. But I think that Luke Getsy gets that going into the season. This is probably my second best pass catcher when it comes to, you know, 10, 12 plays that I want to scheme for. So I think that Cole is going to play a very instrumental part of the offense early on. And it's not going to be Travis Kelce-like numbers. It's going to be, you know, Cole had six catches, but four of those went for first downs, and maybe one of them was a touchdown. I think that, to me, would be a tremendously productive season for him.
Great stuff. Game week next week, Dan, so get ready.
Yes,
all right?
Sir.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
We'll be ready to rock.
There you go.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
You got it. Dan Durkin, Can't Miss Radio. He's a great addition to our show, Waddle and Sylvie. He's been covering football in this town for a lot of years, and he knows how to break down the film. Also, later in the show, I want to play the Kurt Warner stuff on Justin Fields as well. Jesse's got the update, the breaking news story from the afternoon, not only on the Bears, but also on the White Sox. Tony La Russa did not manage yesterday's game, and now the White Sox are without him indefinitely. So he is getting further medical testing with his doctors in Arizona. Does this mean we could be at the end of the Tony La Russa second era? We'll talk to Jesse Rogers about that coming up next.
Hey, if you have the first overall pick, make sure you select Twin Peaks for your fantasy football draft party. Stay cool under pressure with 29-degree ice-cold draft beers made from scratch food for the whole team, including the outstanding smoked wings, crispy mini beef tacos, and new spicy Thai ribs. Plus, your commissioner will receive a $50 bonus card and an additional $5 bonus card for every drafter. Now, that's a draft party. Visit TwinPeaksRestaurant.com/fantasy draft for more info. Twin Peaks eats, drinks, scenic views.
You're listening to Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000.
Chicago's home for sports.
Follow at Waddle and Sylvie and at TWaddle87 on Twitter.
Today's a very, very busy day. The Bears and their claims, they claim six different players. Really good breakdown from Dan Durkin. If you missed them, make sure you check it out on the podcast.
I liked what he said as well about the kid from Minnesota. It was the first thing that I thought as well. I know that Leatherwood has caught everyone's attention because he's the 17th pick of last year's draft, but Armand Watts, Scott, was a starter and participated quite a bit. Five sacks for the Vikings last year. You know, I think he's a young guy that can fill a role here.
I would think with Leatherwood, too, that I mentioned this yesterday. Poles scouted last year's draft, obviously, for the Chiefs. And didn't the Chiefs totally remake their offensive line through free agency and trades? They were in the, hey, we need to improve our offensive line mode, like most teams do. So I'm sure he scouted Leatherwood very closely and had thoughts on him. So, you know, and guys, you remember guys you like, and then all of a sudden, boom, someone, Eberflus said some good things about him, that how good of a run blocker he is, and that they were very surprised that he was available. So
we'll
see where he fits. It's a buy low, can't lose situation when you're rebuilding. Jesse Rogers also, huge news on the south side with Tony La Russa. Tony did not manage yesterday. The update today that Jesse has confirmed that Tony is out indefinitely, and he is seeing his doctors in Arizona. Jesse Rogers is brought to you by your Chicagoland Toyota Dealer Association. Toyota, let's go places. You were the last to see Tony walking off the field yesterday. What'd you do to him?
What'd I do to you guys? Drive him nuts, probably, right? he was in the dugout and welcoming Dave Stewart, you know, his former pitcher from the Oakland A's, to into the clubhouse. And right before they went down there, I grabbed him because I needed something about Albert Pujols. And I tell you, he gave me a great answer, was in good spirits. And then I made sure to follow up today. Nothing happened between then and game time. He didn't faint. He didn't pass out. He got news from his doctors. And I've been trying to do some research. Maybe you could have a cardiologist call in. But whatever the news was, it was, hey, don't manage, don't deal with that stress. You got to back off. We've got to investigate this a little further. So I think he had some tests done early in the week. They came back in this moment and said, look, you better back off because this could lead to something. And so now he's on the plane to Arizona to see, I think, his own doctors or specialists or whatever the case may be. So,
With that in mind, Jess, I was going to say, look, I don't know much about these situations, but I would think serious, yes, but if they're allowing him to actually leave and go back to Arizona and fly to see his own doctors, that would be encouraging that, you know, it's not something that's catastrophically bad.
Right. It could be catastrophically bad if he continues on and doesn't address it.
Right.
That's it. I mean, I even texted with him last night. Now, all I said was, hey, Tony, we were just talking. What happened? And hope you're well. And he said, thanks. He didn't. So my point is he was coherent. He was texting, you know. And today they even reiterated he's okay. Miguel Cairo, now managing, said that. And the fact that he is getting on a plane. So it's all preventive. He must have got some news between 6 and 7 last night, probably with Dave Stewart sitting in his office. And they said, hey, hold off on this kind of stress, right? And we know this has been a stressful season. So Miguel Cairo is going to take over. And, you know, it's a tall task. They're 6 out and he's not playing good baseball.
Do you believe that this is sort of the end then? Or do you see a scenario that the doctors say, hey, Tony, you're okay, go back. And the Sox have him back? Or do you believe that this is the break and this is the exit?
I believe it's the exit, but don't hold me to it. Knowing Tony, if he's cleared, he'd probably get back on a plane. But if it was so urgent that he couldn't manage one more game and then get on the plane, I can't imagine he's cleared tomorrow and he's back. So this feels like, hey, you need to get some rest and relax here, right? You're 78. You're managing a baseball team over 162. So yes, it feels like that would be the thing to do, but I don't know for sure. I just know this. Tony does care so much, probably too much, that he'd probably do whatever he can to get back. And the players kind of echoed that. And it's probably why he's in the position that he's in, so stressed out, because he put so much into it. Not that much has returned, right? He hasn't gotten much out of all that effort and anxiety. It just hasn't worked out with him here this year. So I imagine that this has got to be it. It'd be different if for 3 months left. Okay, take 3 weeks off and come back. You know, Francona missed a lot of time in recent years. But this is a month left in the season, and there's 6 out. I mean, what's the point? I mean, he's not back tomorrow. It would be a few days at least. And what would be the point? So I have to imagine it. But with Tony, you never say never.
Do you know who this quote is from? Take a guess, Jesse. This is from a prior year. Quote, the rigors and stress of the job have caused me some minor physical problems in the past few years, so therefore I'm walking away from the team.
Tony in 2011?
No. It's from Jerry Krause in 2003 on During the Rebuild as it was failing on how Reinsdorf and Krause were able to make the clean break with the stress and the health issue. Like, a lot of people believe that this is an easier way than to point the finger, to point a blame, to say, hey, I'm walking away, I'm resigning, to say, hey, Tony, you're fired. Say, guys, let's just wrap this thing up here.
But let's be clear. You don't believe this is a made-up situation.
No.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I was saying, from the start, like, why would he even want that? He has said, before he came back, he has said, we have quotes from it, from that interview that was on Fox, where a lot of people didn't think he would come back because he has had health issues.
Right.
Like,
right.
What do you want from your already illustrious career? What do you have to prove with these health issues to begin with? So I would never say that. But what I'm saying is it's an easier way to sort of now finally make this all go away.
Oh, there's no doubt it's an easier way. And it's also, it might be the right way. I mean, if he's 78 and having heart problems here 5 months into a season, now he wants to come back at 79 with a whole city, you know, against him in a sense. Like I don't know if he'd be in this situation if he was 6 games up instead of 6 games down, right? It's stressful to lose and he wears it. So, yeah, it's definitely easier and it's probably the right thing for his own health. Thing is, he's just such a lifer in this. You know, when he quit the first time, he just went up to the front office and came to the ballpark every day with three different teams. until the only team in baseball would hire him back actually hired him back. So he's just such a lifer. But yes, this, you would think this would be the, you know, way for Rick Hahn, Kenny to go to Jerry, or Jerry to go to Tony and just say, look, your health comes before everything. So it does feel like, you know, the beginning of the end in terms of managing. But you never say never, because we were all shocked that he came back in the first place.
Okay, Jess, they've lost 5 in a row now, 10 of their last 12. They're 3 games under 500. I believe there's 7 back in the loss column. Giolito has lost the good stuff on a consistent basis. It's a team riddled with injuries. Paint me a picture to how this thing gets turned around, not before the end of this season, but how do they get themselves back on track, and what kind of changes may be on the horizon?
Well, I'll go back to Sylvie's homework assignment for me last week, because it does probably have to start with the hitting coaches. To be honest, this team needs a hitting change philosophy along with personnel changes. You know me, they need some balance. Gavin Sheets is starting to come alive as a lefty hitter, but they need more than that. They need some balance. But this team, under this hitting philosophy, guys, the numbers are so bad. And they did lead the American League in home runs in the shortened season in 2020. But from everything I could gather, that was kind of flukish. For all I know, the wind was blowing out, or it was just 60 games and they got lucky, because all the things that I see statistically, analytically, points to a team that is not built to hit home runs, or simply doesn't. Let me read one thing for you. There's some stats that I want to get to. One of them's called topped. You know how you top the ball, you hit it into the ground? They actually keep measure of this. And let me just read the one sentence description of topped balls. T-O-P-P-E-D. Top balls are almost exclusively comprised of batted balls hit at a negative launch angle directly into the ground. This season, the White Sox ranked number one in topped percentage. They ranked 28, or number two last year, 29th. So they were their first this year in top balls. They were second last year in top balls. And actually, even in 2020, they ranked up there. I mentioned launch angle to you guys before. They rank near the bottom in terms of launch angle, just that uppercut swing that creates home runs. They rank at the bottom of the league. They were near the bottom last year. Frank Menachino took over in 2020. So every year that he's been here, things have gone south in terms of power. They like to preach, use the whole field, but it seems like they're giving up power to do that. And last thing, just using launch angle, for example, not even home runs, just launch angle. Of the top 12 launch angle teams, meaning the ones that hit with the highest launch angle, 11 are going to be in the postseason. Only the Texas Rangers are in the middle. 11 of the top 12 are going to be in the postseason, the ones that hit home runs. The Atlanta Braves won the World Series with home runs last year. They will win it or lose it based on home runs this year. That's how this sport works right now, and the Sox, by design, do not hit for home runs.
So for anyone who wants to say, hey, the ball doesn't travel like it used to, the ball's not traveling when you're hitting it into the ground. Like, this is more than just, and like, as you've pointed out, whether it's Christopher Morel hitting 13 home runs for the Cubs, that would put him second on the White Sox, whether it would be Albert Pujols, who is an old man and is a part-time player, would lead the White Sox in home runs. This is not a ball issue. This could be a philosophical issue.
Oh, I think it definitely is. Add on to it that they are near the top of the league in chasing the last 3 years. So you know how it works. If pitchers know you're going to chase, they're going to throw you less meatballs. And there's actually a, quote, meatball percentage stat on one of the websites. Sylvie, you would love that.
With our callers, meatball, too, we have that.
We have a high percentage.
And think about this. They're one of the worst at swinging at meatballs. So they chase. They don't swing at the cookies. I think I've said this to you before. I feel like Eloy Jimenez is one guy that will launch a meatball. So think of all that combined. Bad launch angle, hitting it in the ground, and they don't swing at meatballs. All of that adds up to less home runs than you should be hitting. Or it could be philosophy, or it could be personnel, or both. And let me mention one more thing. You know, John Mealy was the launch angle king, right, with the Cubs? Just to give you how it works, the last year he was there, the Cubs were near the top. As soon as he left, they went to Chili Davis, remember?
Yeah.
They were the fifth lowest in terms of launch angle in 1 year. So it does matter who the hitting coach is. That philosophy seeps into the players. You're at the top, and then you're at the bottom. 3 years of Menachino, They've been pounding the ball into the ground much more than hitting it in the air.
Let me ask you a basic question, though, about like a player that's as accomplished as Jose Abreu. Why on God's green planet would he change his approach at the plate? He has got more of a resume than any hitting coach out there.
And he hit 19 home runs in that shortened season, which was huge. 19 in 60 games. You know,
that's
play that
crazy. And he's got 14 this year?
Yeah,
14. That's it. I don't know the answer to that. It just, the last couple of years, like I said, the hitting philosophy seeps into the players. And I talked to a hitting coach the other day. He said, we use the whole field, which sounds great. But when there's a home run to be had, you need to take it. You need to hit the meatball. So it just feels like this hitting philosophy has taken hold. It just like Chili Davis tried to take hold and it didn't work. This has taken hold and it's not working in terms of power. They do lead in like oppo hitting, singles. We know that there's some things they do well, but you'd rather have the home runs than the singles any day of the week, of course.
Yeah, hey, look, don't blow it up for the White Sox, but there are lots of changes. The manager, the hitting coach, hopefully the new way of business with fitness and training and making these guys a little bit lighter on their feet and not have to have such tired legs for a young team. It is crazy. Any other news or notes, Jesse, you want to pass along?
And I just want to say, you got to stop chasing bad pitches because you'll never get a strike. So, Javi Baez can tell you all about
sure,
that.
Sure, and you got to change some of the players. You can't you can't just do what the Cubs did for those many years and thinking all the other changes will change the players. We've talked about it all year. This is not just a Tony issue. This is not just a this issue. This is a player issue. It's a redundancy problem, and they need to fix that as well.
Yeah, so Miguel Cairo is going to manage. And, you know, the rallying cry is kind of win for Tony. I mean, for people from a baseball perspective, if you wanted Tony fired, there's a 50-50 chance if they had done it, Miguel Cairo would be your manager. So I guess you'll see what happens without Tony there and Miguel in there. But it's probably too big of a hill to climb. Luis Robert remains out of the lineup. He's day-to-day with this hand thing. They don't really need to put him on the IL with the rosters expanding by 3 tomorrow so they can hide him some more. But, you know, he's out. Tim Anderson's out. Nothing's changed there. So Grandel is back, but you know it's probably too little, too late there.
Yeah, well, he's provided too little. That's in general, not too late. He's provided too little. Good stuff, Jesse.
Thanks,
thank you.
Okay, guys, take care.
Jesse again, brought to you by your Chicagoland Toyota Dealer Association. Toyota, let's go places. 332-3776. Wilbon coming up. I also in the 5 o'clock hour want to play the Kurt Warner stuff on Justin Fields. People on hold want to talk about my top 10 most disappointing Chicago sports seasons. I will reintroduce that list, let you talk about it coming up next.
Oh, yeah. Look at you over there.
Yeah, give me
yourself one.
Miller Lite.
It's Miller time. Celebrating Miller time all year, every day. You should join in on the fun. It's delicious and exhilarating. Taking the show on the road throughout the rest of the year, courtesy of our great friends and partners at Miller Lite. And next Friday, huge broadcast to kick off the Bears season. We will be at Benny's in Lincoln Park, one of our favorite places, live broadcast 2 to 6. Stop on by. We'll be giving away Bears tickets for that Sunday's game. Enjoy. It's Miller time at Benny's, and please celebrate responsibly.
You're listening to Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000.
Chicago's home for sports.
Follow at Waddle and Sylvie and at TWaddle87 on Twitter.
All right, so we continue to follow the La Russa story. You heard from Jesse. Bears cuts. Wilbon coming up at 5. And then I want to play you some Kurt Warner from earlier today. Spurred by the 2022 Sox, we've been talking all week and for the last couple weeks that I would eventually do a top 10 most disappointing Chicago sports team list. I made it from the last 25 years, dating back to 97. And remember, the 97 year, too, was the white flag trade. So my list, I put honorable mention, or as Waddle says, 10B, the 16 White Sox. Number 10, the 16-17 Bulls. That was the three alpha Bulls. I got some pushback on the 06 Sox, but I checked in with Carmen on this one. They were 8 games under .500 in the second half, trying to repeat. That's what made them disappointing. The 06 White Sox, 9. The 12 Bears, number 8. The 18 Cubs, number 7. The 97 Sox, number 6 of the white flag trade. The 19 Bears, number 5. That was of recent memory. The 07 Bears are number 4. That was the team trying to get back to a Super Bowl. The 14 Bears that were so dysfunctional, bad. And this is one of my few really bad teams on the list. They were just so embarrassing. They're number 3. 2022 White Sox, number 2, and the 04 Cubs are my number 1 most disappointing team.
I like your list. I respect your list, and I respect the fact that it's your list. So if anybody doesn't like it, they can kick rocks. That's how you're supposed to handle that.
Is that how it's the analyst goes?
Yeah, that's how you're supposed to handle it.
Jack wants to weigh in Humboldt Park. This is Jack Silverstein, who does... He's a great Chicago sports historian. What'd you think of the list, Jack?
I thought it is a great list. I agree with Waddle. It's, you know, list or list, kick rock.
That's right.
It's funny. I saw this pop up, and it's a great list, but it's also something that we kind of all talk about, these sorts of things. So I didn't expect to see this and have my heart sink. But every time I think about the 2004 Cup, it doesn't matter that we've won the World Series. Every time I'm hurt.
Kicking the nuts. It's a big kick in the nuts.
Yeah, and the way I think about it is like, if you think about like the Bartman game into game 7. After the Bartman game, I still thought we were going to win game 7. And in fact, I was at Indiana in college, and someone who I met at the bar out watching the game said, me and my friends were driving back to Chicago, you want to come with? And I was thinking like, that's a really desperate move for a team that's in a great position. We've got Woody on the mound. And then, of course, Game 7 was so devastating. And I look at those two seasons as those two games. 2003, on a whole, felt more like the Bartman game. There was still some hope afterward. And 2004, on a whole, felt like that Game 7 loss at Wrigley to Florida, where it never occurred to me. We got D. Lee. We got Greg Maddux.
Right.
Michael Barrett. Obviously, we got Nomar at the deadline.
Right.
And we were leading in the wild card. St. Louis was way ahead, but we were leading in the wild card with the week to go. It never occurred to me that we would have that complete and utter meltdown. And to this day, 04 is the worst. And
yeah,
I've got the rest of my list. I don't want to spend time, but 04 is the worst to me.
That's good, Jack. Tweet me your list too. I want to compare it. I appreciate you, all right?
Thanks, Jack.
I will. And let's go Sky tonight so we don't have all these disappointments.
Amen to that, Jack.
All right, guys.
There's Jack. Well, he's awesome. And it was just an unlikable. It wasn't just underachievement. It was the unlikability of that team. And it reminds me so much of this 2022 White Sox team. The Sox team, I'm watching more from afar, less, you know, my heart isn't in this because I'm not a Sox fan. The Cubs, it was my heart. And rebounding from 03 and that devastation from the postseason, you thought, hey, they would be like one of these teams that's a good overcoming story, kind of like how the Bulls lost to the Pistons all those years, but then they eventually got better for it, and then they eventually just got worse. Michael Wilbon weighs in, coming in next. Did he take advantage of the free food out in Ireland? Remember, it wasn't just free beer, it was free food.
Right.
Did he wait in those lines, and he'll tell us about the experience? And I know he's very into the Sky. The Sky have to win tonight, too. Michael Wilbon coming up next.